Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the Statehouse Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of January 22nd, 2019. This week, we look at Governor McMaster's recently released budget, which is a blueprint to his second State of the State address, and the unity among lawmakers to make education reform a top priority. Also, Democratic presidential hopefuls are gearing up for 2020 and are already scoping out South Carolina. The Lead is a podcast where we go behind the headlines with the reporters who write the stories affecting you. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. You can listen to all four sections instead of wondering about that Saints fan who changed those highway signs, wondering if he still has a job today, or worrying about that mythical monster that was awoken by the super blood moon. God help us. But isn't this what happened on Stranger Things? No? I don't. And now, quorum call. Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present, but here in the South Carolina Lead, we know a majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. Number one, in some local shutdown news, a fast-moving bill arrives in the South Carolina Senate this week that would exempt federal employees in South Carolina from paying late penalties on their real property tax bills. This bipartisan bill is meant to help federal employees who have missed a paycheck due to the partial shutdown over border wall funding and could soon miss another if it's not resolved. The shutdown is now into its second month, the longest in U.S. history. Number two, the state newspaper reports that Fairfield County School District agreed to give all full-time employees a bonus in December if they stick around or come to work for the district in August. This is one way leaders say to attract and keep needed teachers in schools. Now, Fairfield School District Superintendent J.R. Green said other staff members, such as bus drivers and clerical workers, will receive a $3,000 bonus. Number three, the Post and Courier reports that a federal judge ruled that the permitting process for offshore seismic testing cannot resume until after the partial federal shutdown is resolved. U.S. District Judge Richard Gergel also ruled that work couldn't proceed until after he rules on an accompanying motion by South Carolina Attorney General Alan Wilson. The Trump administration in early January called back Bureau of Ocean Energy Management workers to process offshore seismic testing permits in the Atlantic. The testing, which involves loud air gun blasts underwater, is a precursor to offshore drilling for oil and gas. Now, both are widely opposed on the coast due to the risk to the environment and tourism economy. Number four, the state newspaper reports that in a joint letter, Governor McMaster, State Senate President Harvey Peeler, and House Speaker Jay Lucas asked State Revenue and Fiscal Affairs Office Director Frank Rainwater to develop a new funding formula to pay for South Carolina schools with the help from the South Carolina Department of Education and others. Now, the report will be issued in May and will also look at teacher pay and school district consolidation. And just like Tom Brady crushing another fan base's hopes and dreams, we've buried the lead. This week, we're looking at Governor Henry McMaster's recently released executive budget that includes money for teacher and police pay raises, school security, tax rebates, economic development funding, and more. Also this week was the official start to the 2020 Democratic presidential primary race, with the annual Dr. Martin Luther King Day ceremony March to the Dome, where visiting Senators Bernie Sanders and Cory Booker, both potential 2020 hopefuls, gave speeches out front of the statehouse after marching several blocks with others. This is one of several important events Democratic presidential hopefuls attend leading up to the primaries. But first, let's get some more details on McMaster's budget. To talk about all this and more is the Associated Press's Meg Kennard and the state's Mayan Schachter. Welcome to you both, especially Mayan, a first-timer on the lead here.
Hooray!
I'm very excited.
I know, this is also very exciting because it's an episode of several firsts. It's the first time we've had two female guests. It's the first time I got everyone coffee because we've all had a long morning and we're all a little frozen. It's the first time the state newspaper's been on the lead, and it's the first time I've worn tights while forming, while taping anything. So this is exciting. Everyone, again, thank you for being here. And Mayan, let's just start with you. Talk about the budget, the governor's press conference last week. He unveiled his budget. We got some more details about where he's going with things, some more specifics ever since his inaugural address. We're going to see some more coming with the state of state address. But what really jumped out to you from this budget? Obviously, we have that extra $1 billion to spend this year. Where's it going, and does it seem like it's getting a good reception so far?
Well, I have lawmakers channeling me right now because they'll say, yes, we have $1 billion in new money, but, you know, over $500 million of that is one one-time money can only be spent on one-time costs. So really, we don't have $1 billion in your money. But I think the big thing that everybody was looking for was the teacher pay raises. Mm-hmm. Certainly, education is at the forefront of the legislative session right now. And teachers specifically wanted to know how much the governor was going to call for. And he called for that 5% pay raise, which is totaling about $155 million. So certainly that was the big key item. The governor also proposed, I think it was $46 million, to put a school resource officer in every single school. As you'll recall, last year, he also added that money in his executive budget, but the legislature put in a very, very small amount, which only put SROs in about, I think, 38 schools. Those were the two big education mm-hmm. ones. He called for a $200 million tax rebate, something that has not been done before in the state of South Carolina, according to the governor's office. And depending on who you ask, it'll happen or it won't happen. He also, again, reiterated his proposal for income tax exemptions for first responders and veterans. And he also made a point to say that he was willing to work with the legislature as they tackle tax reform this session.
And then, Mayan, I mean, this is still early. It's the governor. He's proposing this. It's not definite by any means. I mean, where does this go from here? Is it, do lawmakers look at this and say, oh, hey, this is great, but we're already in the House and we're already doing our own budget? Are they being receptive to what he's been proposing so far?
Well, I certainly think that's usually the attitude with most executive budgets proposed by the governor. But it does seem like this one is a little bit different, that the governor is going to work in tandem, particularly with House leadership, House Speaker Jay Lucas and Ways and Means Chairman Merle Smith and House Republican leader Gary Simrell. Mm-hmm. I think you'll see a lot of side-by-side action there. I think the big question is the Senate, but it seems that there is leadership in the Senate side that is on board with what the governor is asking for as well.
And Meg, this is kind of different from what we've seen before with lawmakers working with the governor and them kind of like saying one thing and then lawmakers saying, thanks for the budget, but we're going to do this our way. I mean, is this a different era in South Carolina
state politics?
It's
a little bit different take this time. You know, as we've talked about before, the governor can say a lot of things, but until he gets that important buy-in from the legislature, particularly as Mayan was noting, from both chambers, not just one or the other, then he can really maybe start to get some things done. So this session, obviously, everyone's talking about education, saying that that's their number one priority. For us to see the governor and the leaders of both chambers, the speaker and the Senate president, coming out and all talking about education, sending a letter to the financial folks in the state saying, mm-hmm. look, we really want to take a hard look at the funding formula, which is the big boogaboo, is the big difficult issue that you can't just easily push forward. It's going to take a long time to figure out how to change that. To see all of those voices at least talking about trying to get to the same goal is a little different. Now, as we've previously noted, the ways we get there could vary a lot from what the governor would want specifically to what the legislative leaders would want. In his State of the State address, I would imagine we're going to hear Governor McMaster give some of those specifics about, okay, well, I'm going to give money. I would like to give money to teachers. I would like to have SRO money for each school in the state. These are all things I would push forward, but maybe getting a little bit more specific as to where some other money for other things could come from. We're going to get some of those specifics, I would imagine, from the State of the State address. Whether the lawmakers agree with those ideas remains to be seen.
Mm-hmm. And Mayan, it kind of sounds like, you know, Meg touched on it in one of our quorum call items, is about, you know, this letter that McMaster and Senate President Peeler and House Speaker Jay Lucas sent to the Revenue and Fiscal Affairs Office asking to look at a new formula, to look at district consolidation. That's not supposed to come back till later in the session. So I'm wondering, you know, is a lot of this stuff maybe we're getting put up front early so we can get these kind of maybe seemingly easy wins? And then the bigger stuff, looking at the formula, how education's funded going forward. I mean, that's some really heavy lifting stuff. Is it just kind of maybe let's use some goodwill we have right now and then look at the more difficult issues that could prove some division?
Yeah, I think the legislature is under a lot of pressure to do something quick this year. I do think that teachers, for the most part, recognize that reforming, overhauling the entire K-12 system is a huge undertaking and is not going to be done in 1 year, maybe not even done in one session. But teachers are looking for at least that pay raise. I would be surprised if we didn't see any movement on a pay raise this year, only because you have teachers that are being much more vocal about their wants and needs this year than I think in years prior. So to me, the pay raise issue may be the quickest fix for them, and certainly reforming the entire formula is... I don't know if it can be done this year. I mean, it takes the legislature a long time to do certain things. We think about the gas tax, mm-hmm. and the roads bill, and how long mm-hmm. that took. So I don't think overhauling K-12 education is a 1 year fix.
And, you know, we're looking at the teachers, we're looking like their attitudes towards what's happening here in Columbia. Obviously, it seems like there's been a lot of discussion right now from lawmakers, but do you think a lot of this, Meg, is maybe to kind of maybe prevent teachers from feeling that they're excluded, to maybe to help diffuse any possible strike situation? I mean, I know there's been some of that discussion in the offseason, but it seems like things are maybe in a good place right now because there has been such a reception in Columbia to the needs of educators.
Right. There is an approaching boiling point among South Carolina's teachers. That's no secret. And there is a lot of discussion of what's happening in places like California, where there are active teacher strikes going on. From what I hear from educators and people within the education community, they're not quite to that point yet, but it may not be far off. So as we've talked about, maybe some of these short-term, easier, more low-hanging fruit items, like putting forward the teacher pay raise, which is very significant, but as Maya noted, that's a little bit easier than a long-range battle for the funding formula changes. So there is a chance that something like that could mollify some of that disruption and that frustration that has been building gradually over many, many years among South Carolina's teachers. There was talk very recently over at the State House where there was the MLK Day rally where mm-hmm. we all were, and there were possible presidential contenders, but there were also members of the education community standing up and yep. taking note and saying, look, you know, we're all here. So while we have people's attention, let's mention things like education that we really, really need to make some strides on. So in the education community, I think there's a bit of hope, but I don't think that there will be any real level of mollification or satisfaction until they actually see some of these ideas that have a lot of support go into practice.
During the inauguration speech, and even during some comments going forward since then from lawmakers, there is that solidification around, you know, this need to fix the education system. Mayan, do you think that this is something that we could hear? Obviously, we're going to hear from in the governor's State of State address on Wednesday, but is this going to be something that he could really maybe make into a legacy issue for himself in the way that he is working so closely with lawmakers, and it doesn't seem like he's worried about, you know, giving the impression that he's not doing it all of himself and he's willing to work with others? Is that because maybe this could be, I mean, a win is going to be a win regardless if people see it coming from the State House or if they see it coming from the governor's mansion? I mean, is this something that he is kind of really hitching his wagon to at this point, you think?
I think from the public's perspective, a win is a win, no matter how it gets there. But I think from the legislature's standpoint, having the governor take this issue, not just him, but also his new lieutenant governor, Pamela Vett, mm-hmm. take this issue and run with it is a huge win for the legislature. He has the bully pulpit. He is the one who's able to go across the state. I mean, the governor's office told us that he and the lieutenant governor will be hopping from Rotary Club to Rotary Club, pitching education reform and pitching their proposal. So certainly from the lawmaker standpoint, it's really important to have him beating the drum as loud as he can. And he can get that press pretty easily especially when he's in these small cities or in these areas that don't normally, have someone there at the State House. So mm-hmm. this is, yes, it's big for the legislature to have him in their corner.
And taking that kind of a tour around the state, spending the time speaking at Rotary meetings and things of that nature, in that process, we're going to see one of the first real tests of having the governor and the lieutenant governor having run on a ticket, coming mm-hmm. into office as a team, being on the same page. We've all kind of been wondering, like, what is Pamela Vett really going to be tasked with as lieutenant governor? We've known that the governor was going to be giving her responsibilities, but, you know, up until now, it was really kind of like, oh, she's going to deal with the legislature, she's going to help negotiate, things like that. This is going to be one of the first times that we've really seen her come into that role and go out and speak to the communities that she was speaking to already on the campaign trail. Mm-hmm. Now she's going to be coming back with the message of the administration on this number one issue. So we're really going to get to see her in action in that regard.
Yeah, and it's interesting you said that, bringing her up, because we did see her at the budget unveiling at the press conference. And then later that week, I saw her, you know, just on the House floor. And, you know, lawmakers, Democrats, Republicans were just excited to see her out there. So it's almost like they're excited just to have that representation from the executive branch up there, but to also have someone that they can go up to and just, you know, even if it doesn't go anywhere, I mean, she's going to be there. She's going to take in the criticism and the feedback she hears from these guys. And maybe it goes somewhere, maybe it doesn't. But I think it's just that matter of having someone, a face that they go and talk to.
Right.
And I think that makes a big difference. So
sure.
It's going to be interesting to see her role going forward. Maya, you want to say something?
Well, I was just going to say it's a really good test for her to see what she can do mm-hmm. Within both chambers, how well she can sell the governor's message as well. So it'll be really interesting to see how she communicates that individually with lawmakers.
And we all of us came from the Martin Luther King Day event up at the State House. Meg, you are on 2020 watch, acting like it's 2020 already. We're a good more than a year away.
The watch
away.
Is over.
February 29th, 2020 is the Democratic presidential primary in South Carolina. So what's it going to be like leading up to then, Meg? I mean, we saw a lot of candidates come out today. We saw Bernie Sanders. We saw Cory Booker. We're going to see a few more this week. We heard Mayor Stephen Benjamin of Columbia say that the road to the White House starts in South Carolina. Why is that for our listeners who aren't maybe, you know, living on every little thing about 2020? Why is it such a big deal for South Carolina to have these folks come through South Carolina and to get their votes from these people?
We've got the first in the South primary. It's been the case for some time, but South Carolina really is the first place for candidates competing in either the Democrat or the Republican primary to get their message out, particularly to on the Democratic side of things, to get it out to an African-American voting audience. Mm-hmm. So now we have several announced Democratic candidates. None of them were here today, but some of them are going to be here later in this week. But beginning with the run-up to the 2018 midterm elections, we saw potential candidates coming, flocking. We've talked about them before, but mm-hmm. it just seemed like there was a constant stream. Took a break from that for a little while, but I would say that with today's events, with the MLK Day rally at the State House and the march, the prayer breakfast, and the other meetings that are continuing on the sidelines, the race is officially here now. With Cory Booker, who's been here before, with Bernie Sanders, who's been here before, they're back. They're going to continue to come back. We're going to have more candidates here later this week. Elizabeth Warren is slated to be in the state on Wednesday. Kamala Harris, who announced her candidacy on MLK Day, forewent the whole notion of an exploratory committee and just went ahead and announced her campaign. She's going to be here on Friday. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to have some other candidates coming through next week. So I would say that there's not going to be much of a let up from now until when we see that primary actually happen a year from now. And with the number of candidates who are mulling bids, who are thinking about it, I would wager that it's only going to get heavier from here on out.
Well, it's interesting to hear because you were there with Jim Clyburn, the majority whip representative from South Carolina, and he was saying that he doesn't make endorsements because he doesn't want to, you know, he told the party he's not interested in giving endorsements because he doesn't want to, you know, create some sort of vacuum
right.
for this whole place. Does that make it obviously more interesting to see what could happen here in South Carolina for these folks to come in here and actually have to go door to door, event to event, Rotary clubs, upstate, you know, Midlands, et cetera, to get these voters to actually make a difference in this race?
Sure. I mean, with Jim Clyburn now being the House Majority Whip, his endorsement would be a great one, but he traditionally doesn't do that. He sits on the sidelines and doesn't want to see this as any sort of a coronation for the party nominee. So in that regard, candidates really do have to show their muster here to get out to meet voters. And voters are ready for that. They're excited for that. Now that South Carolina has had this cemented place on the early primary calendar, particularly for the Democrats going into 2020, voters are ready to hear from them, to have that up-close personal experience that you really only get in an early voting state like this one. So there are going to be many of them, and the voters are going to have a lot of opportunities to hear directly from those candidates. And reporters like us are going to get the chance to hear those stump speeches over and mm-hmm. over and over, but we'll also be able to interact directly with the voters and hear from them how they're feeling about it. There are going to be a lot of choices. A lot of choices who are also in the U.S. Senate. So those candidates are going to be trying to differentiate themselves and put their best face forward and show voters, why me? Why am I different? Why should you pick me? But there's going to be a lot of opportunity to really hear from them up close and personal and firsthand.
And like we were saying, Mayan, that march today at the Dome at the State House, there was several hundred people gathered out there. It seemed like a lot of them did stick around for the end to hear these speeches from Cory Booker and from Bernie Sanders. Was there any way that did you hear anything different from either of them that might have resonated more with the crowd one way or the other in terms of if it was more of a Booker crowd or a Bernie Sanders crowd? Or what is it? Do you think people were, again, just maybe getting to understand about who these guys were, who these guys are, and maybe what to expect going forward?
Yeah, the folks that I talked to seem to want to hear from both Booker and Sanders. One person said that, and I think this makes sense, that Booker kind of spoke from a more high-level viewpoint of the country, whereas Sanders really hit specifics and hit areas that he's definitely going to run on, whether it was healthcare, education, gun control, et cetera. Booker mentioned a few of those issues as well. But most of the people I talked to still haven't really made up their mind yet. I mean, like Meg said, there are just so many people that are going to be running for president, particularly on the Democratic side. And I think a lot of Democratic voters are kind of excited about that, maybe a bit overwhelmed, but excited about that because they finally have people to choose and pick from. But as Mike said as well, it's going to be very difficult to differentiate one versus the other. But the folks that I talked to today were just very excited that they were here in South Carolina, period.
And we're going to wrap up a little bit, but I just want to look at there's a rundown. The New York Times has a good little interactive about what it looks like right now, the whole field. There's eight people running. Two are all but certain. Four are likely to run. Eight might run. So, Meg, these folks that are coming through, obviously they have to work with the voters. We talked about that. But are they also, I mean, some are staffing up. Some are, I'm guessing, fundraising. Some are making contacts. Some are also getting these anecdotes. So when they come back, they can say, I remember when I was having chicken, so-and-so. I mean, is that what they're going to be doing? Is there going to be any stopping this, and now that this Pandora's box is open, or is it just going to be like this until next February?
A lot of candidates still need to really get to know South Carolina. Of course, South Carolina needs to get to know them, but they need to develop that relationship with the state so they actually know what they're talking about when they try to reference why South Carolina should care about them. Some of these guys and women have been here before. Kamala Harris, when she comes back on Friday, she has been here before. She was here in the fall as well. But there is going to be a lot of candidates really making that first trip, really spending the time. Kirsten Gillibrand hasn't been here before, so she's going to be coming. She's announced her candidacy as well, but she really needs to get to know South Carolina. This go around, voters are going to have lots of options, and I think that it's even more imperative for the candidates to really impress upon them why should South Carolina pick them. 4 years ago, there weren't nearly as many choices, and there, you know, were very well-known candidates. But voters now really have a lot to weigh, and so it's up to the candidates to really show them, okay, look, South Carolina, I'm not from around here, but here's why you should care about me as a candidate. Here's what I propose I can do for you.
And this isn't too different than what we saw in 2016. It's just this time there are more Democrats than Republicans, obviously. But it is just, it's kind of very reminiscent of 2016, if not.
It's the flip side of the coin. I mean, with a Republican in office, it's natural that there would be many more Democrats vying to represent their party when it comes to the 2020 primary. But yes, it is pretty much like we dealt with in 2016, just the reverse.
And do these guys, I know we're going to wrap up, do they have to schmooze anybody? Obviously, if we're saying Clyburn's off the table, who's, you know, de facto kingmaker for the state, are they just really just having to work and get their message out to the people, and there's no real local party boss or anything like that that they have to go and, like, you know, schmooze to try and get
Let's not
attention.
Forget about Trav Robertson, our state Democrat chair. He will clearly be in touch with all these candidates. He told me today he's hearing from them all the time. But don't forget, we do now have another member who is a Democrat in the South Carolina congressional delegation, Joe Cunningham, down in the 1st District. There is no doubt that as the opposite of what happened in the fall when he was entertaining well-known national-level Democrats who are coming to help him with his campaign, now he is potentially in the position to be able to help guide some of these candidates' visits to his home state. So I would imagine that it would be natural for Democrats to want to campaign a lot in Charleston, but I would imagine that in the 1st District, we're going to see even more of that, maybe trying to pair up and get an endorsement from Joe Cunningham.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he'll have a busy 2020 as well.
Absolutely.
But again, like you're saying, all over the state, they really have to go. And besides, I mean, these Democratic hotspots, obviously, but there will be a lot of activity going forward, no
Certainly.
Doubt. And we'll be gearing up. Thank you again to Meg Kinnard with the Associated Press and the State's Mayan Schachter for visiting me today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, guys. It's that time again for some campaign trail news updates. We're looking at the latest in 2020-related movements affecting South Carolina and also highlights from the state's congressional delegation. So strap in, you whip crackheads. We got plenty to talk about. Let me get a crack! Last week, the U.S. House of Representatives voted 424-1 in adopting Democrat Representative Jim Clyburn's resolution denouncing white nationalism and white supremacy after Iowa Republican Representative Steve King, who in a New York Times article wondered why those terms are offensive. King was previously stripped of his committee assignments. And then on top of that, South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, the only black Republican in the Senate, authored an op-ed in the Washington Post last week speaking out against the damage statements like King's do to the Republican Party and the country. He said, quote, "Some in our party wonder why Republicans are constantly accused of racism. It is because of our silence when things like this are said." He went on to say, quote, "Conservative principles mean equal opportunity for all to succeed, regardless of what you look like or where you're from," Quote, and Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren is making her first trip to South Carolina this week following the launch of her Presidential Exploratory Committee, this according to her organization. Warren will host an organizing event at Columbia College Wednesday evening. More details on the public event can be found on her website. In our final section, did you know we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics, or government? It's named after the parliamentary procedure lawmakers use when speaking to each other. Did you know that South Carolina Public Radio's Russ McKinney is back with more great state trivia?
We're back.
He's back. What do you got for me this week, Russ?
Well, talking a lot about education reform, did you know that as early as 1712, the first free public school was established in South Carolina? In Charlestown then, there was actually an act passed, an act for the founding of a free school in Charlestown in 1712. So the school was for free, the first free school was for poor white children, obviously. And there was some public funds involved, limited amounts, but mostly was funds were bequeathed by some wealthy South Carolinians. But there was one firm requirement for teachers in those first original free public schools in Charlestown. So the question is, what is that one firm requirement? One, had to be a man. B, had to have an appointment, a royal appointment from the governor. C, had to be an Anglican. D, had to have received training in the classics. One of those was a mandatory requirement to be able to teach.
1712
in the first schools, and I'm sure it went on for a few years beyond 1712.
Yeah. You want to run through this again really quick?
Sure. A, a man, had to be a man. B, had to have an appointment from the royal governor of South Carolina. C, had to be an Anglican. And D, had to have had formal training in the classics.
1712. And this is like a generic grade school?
I'm sure.
Okay.
Yeah. It was very early.
I'm just thinking of, like, disciplinarians. I'm angling towards A, just because I think it's a very obvious requirement. it's like A or D. The classics could be a... I'm gonna go ahead and say A. Just has to be a man to be able to teach.
Has to be a man.
That's one firm requirement, yeah.
Well, the answer is C, an Anglican.
An Anglican.
You know, I think many times we overlook just the pervasiveness of the Anglican Church in the early days of South Carolina. And as a matter of fact, that act in 1712 that created that school said that instruction would be required in grammar, other arts and sciences, and also in the principles of the Christian religion.
So not our definition of a public school.
So therefore the
1712 public school,
that's
a little
correct.
More church and
so
state.
So therefore
obviously.
The requirement for the Anglican master, I suppose.
Gotcha. Well, times have changed. Thanks, Russ.
You are welcome.
The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on scetv.org. Listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio and watch This Week in South Carolina, a show where I talk with the newsmakers of the week on SCETV, Fridays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 11:30 a.m. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's super easy-to-use app and scpublicradio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts, search us easily on your Android, the NPR One app, or wherever you find podcasts. Follow us on Instagram at SCLEDEPOD, where you can see photos from the studio, on assignment, and of course our dank memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle, at SCLEDPOD. We have swag, sticker swag that is, so send us a direct message on Twitter or Instagram with your address, and we'll send one your way. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to SCLEDE@SCETV.org. The South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia on January 21st, 2019. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening.
message. Lohan Beach Club is a 2020 exploratory committee. That's how you run for president in Mykonos.
Got my vote, Lindsay.
Chicken bakata.